Dr. Dennis McKenna has spent more than 40 years researching the interdisciplinary study of Amazonian ethnopharmacology and plant hallucinogens. He's conducted extensive ethnobotanical fieldwork in the Peruvian, Colombian, and Brazilian Amazon. His doctoral research at the University of British Columbia focused on the ethnopharmacology of ayahuasca and ocuhe, two tryptamine-based hallucinogens used by indigenous peoples in the Northwest Amazon. He's a founding board member of the Hefter Research Institute and was a key organizer and participant in the Huasca Project, the first biomedical investigation of ayahuasca used by a Brazilian religious group, the UDV. He's also the younger brother of the legendary writer, philosopher, and psychonaut Terence McKenna. And from 2000 to 2017, he taught courses on ethnopharmacology, as well as plants in human affairs, at the Center for Spirituality and Healing at the University of Minnesota. In 2019, in collaboration with colleagues, Dennis incorporated a new non-profit called the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, which aims to marry together modern scientific principles with esoteric knowledge. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with him, and so without further delay, I hope you enjoy this conversation between myself and Dr. Dennis McKenna. It's really great to have you on, Dennis, and thank you very much for accepting my invitation to have a chat.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here. Well, Where are you, by the way?
I'm just on the outskirts of Nottingham City, so home of Robin Hood in England.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it's late for you there.
It's 7 o'clock. It's not too bad. But by the looks of it, you look like you're just in a forest.
Right. Well, I'm not in a forest. This is my virtual background. This is actually the ayahuasca vine on the Big Island that of Hawaii that I planted there, or brought cuttings in there in 1976, actually.
Wow.
So it's a huge vine. And, climbing up a tree here, this was taken about 10 years ago or so. And it knocked the tree down. That's what vines do eventually.
Yeah.
They knock the tree down. So now it's just this big, huge pile of tangled stems and leaves and all that. It's not very pretty, but it's an enormous plant, about 1,500 feet long and, several tons. So these lianas get as big as trees,
Wow.
Sometimes bigger than trees. Anyway, that's what it is.
Well, good. At least there's a story behind it. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, it's better than the messy office behind me that you see otherwise.
Well, I appreciate the aesthetic. I've been a fan of you for some time, and especially as well, Terence McKenna is a consistent source of guidance and insight for me. And I've got so many things that I want to ask you. I'm very excited to get into this. And I suppose the best way to probably start off would be for you to explain what it is you're doing now with things like the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, because it sounds like what you're creating is a kind of modernized temple of Eleusis, a mystery school that seeks to intertwine science and esoteric knowledge.
That's pretty much it. Yes. At least it's founded in the spirit of Eleusis, and that's what we're doing. We actually have a lot of things on the plate now. We've really undergone a lot of growth in the last year, and we're hitting on all cylinders actually right now, and we have many plans. The original idea of the McKenna Academy was kind of an extension of what I was doing before, which I was doing ayahuasca retreats in Peru in collaboration with this woman that lives down there that is now working with me on the academy. And we were doing those things about 3 or 4 times a year. And then we founded the academy. And the idea was that we would continue that and do more like symposia and educational events. And then COVID came along and changed everybody's plans, including ours. made it really not practical to do physical conferences and so on. So we're shifted to virtual stuff, and we've been doing a lot of things on the web. We've done different virtual symposia and things like that. And now that things are lightening up a little bit, we're going to also try to pivot back and do maybe one or two retreats this year. We actually have a big conference in the UK planned for May this year.
Oh, fantastic. Where's that going to be?
Well, it's going to be at this place called St. Giles. It's a English country house, and it's in Oxfordshire, I think.
Okay.
About an hour outside of London. This is the 5-year follow-up to the conference I did in 2017, which you may have heard of, ESPD 50. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm familiar, yes. Yeah, I haven't listened to it recently, but I am familiar with that.
Right. So this is going to be ESPD 55. And this is a website for ESPD 50 because it's been 5 years. And the idea was that we do regular conferences under this sort of brand or whatever you want to call it. So a lot of people are enthusiastic. I think this is going to be a fantastic conference, you know, and we're going to bring a lot of people that we didn't have before and move, you know, explore some areas of ethnopharmacology that are a little more obscure. And that's sort of the idea, you know, to look into the stuff that the esoteric, if you will, the stuff that's overlooked. We know lots about psilocybin. We know lots about ayahuasca. We know lots about some of these other things, and that's all wonderful. And a lot of our in the previous conference, we did talk about those things and so peyote and so on. But this year, we're going to talk about a number of other obscure areas. So it's going to be a fantastic conference. We already have, you know, a place identified and a lot of enthusiasm. And some of the folks that helped organize it before are again engaged. So that's one big project we've got happening. And then next year. And then the other big thing that's taking all our bandwidth is this thing we call biognosis. It has to do with essentially the idea is to build bridges between ancestral knowledge, plant knowledge, and modern scientific knowledge. We're working with a university in Peru, in Iquitos, which I know I have a long connection with some of the investigators there, some of the scientists. So it has several stages, you know, the first stage is we're right in the middle of it right now. The first and second stages have turned out to be about basically documentary, you know, using videography. We are working on a trailer or a short documentary, I guess you could call it, that is going to be out probably in February. And then we'll put that out there. And then if we can get enough interest from either our donor, you know, community or media companies like Netflix or National Geographic, I think both will be interested. We need to get enough funding to do a like 5 to 8 part series of short documentaries, sort of about different aspects of the current state of traditional medicine in the Amazon and kind of the post-COVID, post-ayahuasca tourism, post-globalization snapshot of what's going on with traditional medicine in the Amazon. And, you know, as a prelude, I mean, as it's important, I think, to help people understand that this knowledge is threatened, as are the people and the habitats and the genetics and all of that. It's, you know, just just it's under it it's under stress like every place else. But traditional medicine is still very much alive and vibrant, and people rely on it. And there's a lot of knowledge that's in danger of being lost. So we hope that this documentary can make people wake up to that, realize its importance. And then the next phase, this will probably be, the third phase will be a 3 to 5 year project, and it depends a lot, like everything does, on whether we can get funding. But the next third phase of that will be to work with this herbarium at the university in Iquitos. The university is called UNAP, Universidad Nacional Amazonia Peruana. And the curator of that herbarium is this guy named Juan Ruiz. That is, I have worked with him for 40 years, ever since I went there as a graduate student. And he has incredible knowledge, of the plants, and he bridges traditional knowledge and scientific knowledge. This is what makes him unique.
Right.
Also, it's all in his head. He never writes anything down. He's not that kind of guy. He doesn't think that way. So this is why we want to do this documentary. But then in the next stage, we're going to try to digitize this herbarium. In other words, scan all the specimens. And in that process, there are many, many specimens that have never been even mounted. They're not labeled. They're just in bags, where they were originally collected. So the tedious part, but the important part, is to get as many of those mounted as we can. And then we're going to scan those specimens and put up a database online that will be open access, with all of these collections that will link into different other resources, like genomic databases, ethnobotanical databases, so on, phytochemical databases, so that to basically make this herbarium, which is now kind of a neglected, third world, not, I mean, it has a lot of problems, but it's a gem, and we're going to try and save it, and we're going to try and make it a world-class, world-recognized institution of this plant knowledge. And we even have, in my wildest dreams, what we're going to try and do is represent this in a very interactive way. And we're talking to some amazingly creative VR people and about representing this thing, so that it's more than just you go onto a database and here's the collections. That would be good enough, but what we want to do is create a virtual environment, a virtual rainforest, effectively, where you could actually fly through this rainforest in hyperspace, in cyberspace, and the collections in the herbarium would be scattered through this, right, based on where their location is. So each data point would be like a node in this virtual environment. So you could fly through it, like get the 30,000 foot level, see where the collections are, and then as you zoom in, you can see particular collections. So maybe you want to focus on, okay, where's all the Beta stereopsis, for example, where, and so give me a list of all the collections of Beta stereopsis in the herbarium, right? And then you could zoom in on one and say, okay, this one was collected by Dennis McKenna in 1981, and et cetera, et cetera. So
You
that's
are a busy man.
I'm busy. I'm busy, and I have a vision for this, and this is what I want to do, and the beautiful thing is that it's brought so many people together. I mean, people get it. People, I couldn't possibly do this without a lot of help, and fortunately, people have stepped up, both to actually do the technical aspects of it, And of course, this takes money, and we have to, we have to form a good relation with the university, and the university in Iquitos, you can imagine. I mean, it's got resources, and this herbarium is a important resource. But a third world country, they don't have a lot of funds to support this. So we want to bring this, up into the 21st century and make it, and in the process of doing that, we can network with other institutions, like the Kew Botanical Garden and the Missouri Botanical Garden and other institutions that have these things. I mean, you probably don't follow the world of herbaria so much, but that there's a big push to digitize biology. In other words, create these websites that are basically lists of every known living thing, and do it in a way that's engaging. I just saw one the other day, a couple days ago. Well, I won't. I'll send you a link to this. This
Yeah,
blew
send me a
my
link
mind.
and I can put anything in the description for everyone who's listening. I'll put links in the description box so you can check out what Dennis is talking about.
That would be great. That would be great. So yeah, that's what's keeping me off the streets these days.
Well, what an admirable mission, and I think that's a fantastic idea, and I really hope that you guys can pull this off because we need more things like this, and it's a very interesting time right now for psychedelic research. I mean, after about what 40 years or so of stagnation and propaganda, an interest in psychedelic research has been reinvigorated within Western science. In your opinion, what are the main benefits you feel we would get from a reintroduction of psychedelics into society? What do you imagine to be the kind of knock-on effects of such a reintroduction?
Well, I think there are multiple effects, I mean, the obvious one is that, finally psychedelics are being recognized for their benefits, therapeutic benefits. So integration into medicine, which, they've always been integral to traditional medicine, but now, psychiatry, mental health care, and those sorts of things in what we call mainstream medicine. It's not mainstream at all, in fact, but it's because most people in the world do not have access to mainstream medicine. They still rely on plant medicine and traditional knowledge. But anyway, where you see the psychedelics going, because this is also driven in part by, investment and so on, is the application of things like psilocybin, is especially, getting most of the attention these days, and the potential is to revolutionize healthcare, mental health care in medicine. But in order to do that, you really have to change the model of the way these things are used, because, in the first place, we don't have any very good, the so-called the current list of psychopharmaceuticals, that psychiatry relies on. These things are not very effective when it gets right down to it, and they're things you have to take every day for the rest of your life, even when they do help. So psychedelics, as you know, they can produce transformational experiences that people could really get to the root of their problems, and have insights into whatever their issue is, depression or trauma or addiction or all of these things that we hear, anxiety at the end of life or general anxiety, all of these things we hear that psychedelics are being used for, and the reason that's exciting is that, these are actual solutions to help people, live better lives, essentially, and not have to take medications all of their life. That's the big difference between psychedelics and something like an SSRI. I mean, a psychedelic, many people may take it only a few times in their life, you know, and that's all they need. Well, you can imagine the big pharma companies not interested in that. They're interested in, you know, something you take every day for the rest of your life. That's what they want. But, you know, it's trending that way. What, you know, the revenue model for making money, making this pay in the context of mainstream medicine, is you have to shift the focus to therapy, you know, because all of these things require intense therapeutic commitments, you know, and that's the most expensive component of healthcare. Mental health care is the therapist's time, you know, and the current model is you go see somebody and, you know, you get 10 minutes if you're lucky. You walk out of the room with a prescription and they say, okay, take two and call me in the morning, you know. Doesn't work that way with psychedelics, you know. So psychedelics potentially are transformative, you know, in that respect. But then I think that it you know, it has a much wider impact than just the medical side of it, you know. You don't have to be sick to benefit from psychedelics, you know, as we know, right? These things are tools for understanding consciousness and exploring consciousness, tools for spiritual development and self development without really invoking the mental health model, you know, or the mental illness model. We can all benefit. And you know, so the reintroduction of psychedelics and sort of the re recognition or destigmatization, like maybe is a better word, recognition that these things are valuable. They have been valued in traditional societies for literally thousands of years. We're finally waking up to this. And I think on the societal level, that they can have a huge impact, you know, and make us a more conscious, more compassionate culture on the global level. And we need that, you know, we really need that. So, you know, I often say that psychedelics are they're medicines for the soul is what they are. And the soul exists on a number of levels. You know, they can help heal the individual soul, but also the community soul and the society soul and even the species soul. You know, and if you look at what's happening on all levels, all of these things are very badly wounded. You know, if you look at our relationship to the environment, you know, and the way that we relate to nature, what we're seeing, you know, with the current environmental crisis, climate change, and all this, at the root of it, this is because we're estranged from nature. You know, and the psychedelics give us a way to reorient that relationship, basically to wake up to the fact that we are out of tune with nature, we're out of harmony, and we have to change, you know. And so, you know, as I talk about this, I say we have to wake up, you know, first to what's happening, but then we have to wise up. You know, it's not enough just to get awake to it, we then have to wise up. And what that means, I think, is that we have to start collectively making really smart decisions, you know, about in a by consensus. Of course, consensus is something very hard to come by these days, you know, in any social sphere. You know, it's all about everybody's in their camps, everybody's, you know, fighting like tooth and nail against everybody else. We have to get past that. We have to realize, what the hell? We are a species and we live on this planet along with all the other species. We have to shift towards symbiosis and harmony, and psychedelics can teach us to do that. They can help us. They don't, well, maybe that's the wrong way to put it. They can facilitate our learning how to do that. You know, and but it requires changes in medicine and changes in society and just a whole lot of things. But fortunately, we have these catalysts, you know, And so that I am hopeful that that's where it'll go. And I'm concerned also that, this is something that should have been happening a long time ago. So the problem right now is time is running out. It's literally running out. We have maybe the climate people say maybe we have 10 years to make the decisions about how we're going to change the way we use resources, the way we handle energy, the responses to carbon emissions, and all of the things that are destabilizing the homeostasis, the homeostatic mechanisms that keep the planet tolerable for life. We are destabilizing this. I mean, we're not the only factor, but we're the big factor, and we're the only we actually have the technology and the answers to do this. And but we have to have a consensus that yes, this is where we need to be focusing. And I'm, marshaling all of our resources. I sometimes tell people, if you talk about the future, if you talk about policy and all of these things, you can get bogged down in these stupid arguments. But the point is, if the conversation is not about this, what's the point? Because this is about survival, and so that's my spiel, that's what I try to talk about.
Well, like yourself, I truly believe there is a necessary symbiosis that must take place between spirituality and science. And it seems to me that in terms of history, we've gone from shamanism to science, technology, reductionism, and perhaps we're now seeing with the rise of quantum mechanics and computation and AI and the reigniting of interest in psychedelic research. And a specific one, the fact that the US government is openly acknowledging the reality of UFOs. Well, I don't think anyone would have expected that, but that's happening. So, these things could be moving us towards an era of what I like to call techno shamanism, like an interweaving of the mystical and the scientific. And perhaps, and this, I suppose, is my spark of optimism in a world that's looking pretty chaotic. Perhaps this transition could lead us towards becoming a more enlightened species that's not only developed in technology and logic, but also developed in consciousness and spirit.
You have to have it all. And I think you're exactly right. I think we are in a process of evolving beyond technology and even beyond spirituality and shamanism. We're evolving toward a fusion of these things, and that's part of becoming an enlightened species. I mean, that's part of the wake up and wise up dynamic. We can internalize these lessons, if you will, that we can learn from psychedelics, and we can then try to instantiate them in our institutions, I mean, what you say is absolutely correct. I think what psychedelics has forced science to do in a certain way is to acknowledge the reality of spirit. Psychedelics, medicine has been trying to exorcise spirit for 150 years, and make it totally reductionist and just, well, we're just machines made out of meat, right? And you apply the right monkey wrench, the right molecular monkey wrench, and you can fix the machine. Well, we see where that gets us, So psychedelics forces medicine to step away from that and say, well, hey, there is a spiritual dimension to experience and to our lives. And that's this realm where the true healing and the true learning can take place. And so on the societal level, that's what they're doing. They're catalytic for people in their individual spiritual development, but on the societal level, they can also catalyze this transition to a planetary symbiosis, where
Yeah.
we really reestablish these connections to essentially the Gaian mind. You know, I mean, I believe that the community of species is really an intelligence, but we don't recognize it as such. We're beginning
Yeah.
to look at
Yeah.
different aspects of it, but we're beginning to sort of recognize that this is actually the entire planet is a super organism, you know, and we're part of that. But we're like the part that isn't fitting in yet, and we need to be hit upside the head a few times and get our act straight, you know,
Yeah,
help.
absolutely. I mean, I would liken, and I've said this before, that the kind of resurgence of interest in psychedelics through Western science is kind of like a beautiful Trojan horse, because you're having to look at this through the rational reductionist perspective that you've adopted through the scientific models that have been held up for some time. But coming into this rigid system is this immense challenge to the status quo, because the deeper you go into these compounds and into the states of consciousness that they bring upon you, it becomes very difficult to maintain the paradigm that you had previously around a lot of things, to be honest. But I do find it to be very interesting that this is happening now, and science is going to have to respond to this in a suitable way.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's a process of evolution, and it really is coevolution in a certain way. I think that these things have been coevolutionary partners with the human species for, a very, very long time, possibly a ridiculously long amount of time. But they've always been, like the sort of indigenous communities that have been the stewards of this knowledge and these shamanic practices and so on. They've always been sort of on the fringes, and not really part of the mainstream, tend to be marginalized, and now that's changing, and that's a good thing. I mean, I'm encouraged by the some of the decriminalization
Yeah.
movements that are going on. Even though on a political level there are problems sometimes with the way it approaches, but I think the idea that any plant should be criminalized is ridiculous. You know, I mean, it does not compute. No plant, no organism, no fungus, no nothing should be. We do not have the moral authority as a species to say, okay, coca, you're an evil plant, you need to be eradicated from the planet. No, who, why is it up to us to say that? So we got to change things in those terms. And then what I think it may open up, and where I'd like to see it go is if we can get past this idea that these plants should be prohibited or really regulated by anything other than the people that use them, the authorities that use them, being the shamans and the people in that respect. They should be listened to. Regulatory agencies, law enforcement agencies, medical authorities, all this should have a place at the table. The conversation should include them, but the basic idea is that people should. I've said in various talks, I've said people have a fundamental right to symbiosis, and it should be articulated as a fundamental right. And it's not even a fundamental human right, because we're talking about symbiosis with things that are not human,
Yeah.
and within that framework, I'd like to see rather than ayahuasca tourism or drug tourism, where people go to these indigenous communities and then have that experience, which can be very beneficial for them, but then they go home, and that model creates sometimes problems for those communities. For one thing, it puts pressure on the resources, and we know,
Yeah.
for example, ayahuasca, iboga, peyote, all of these things are endangered plants because of their overuse. So we have to ensure that the supplies are sustainable. So the decrim opens up the possibility that communities in Europe and North America and the UK and in the so-called developed world can develop these healing centers, in that's really community-based, and bring the medicine to the people rather than taking the people to the medicine, and work with indigenous communities to produce these things and, get that commerce going and make sure that it's structured so the communities benefit, sustainable supplies are ensured, and then every community, and they already exist. That's the thing. There are lots of centers that use psychedelics that are underground. They can't operate in the open, but it is happening. So if these communities can come out of the shadows, start to operate in the open, then you've got what you created is a mental health resource for every community, where people can come. And they won't look like clinics. They'll look like spas, or they'll look like a place you might go for an ayahuasca retreat. But they might offer other kinds of things too. Maybe yoga, maybe massage, maybe different kinds of holistic therapies that easily can be integrated with that. But among the menu on the menu or the services offered is, you can choose to have a psychedelic guided trip with an experienced guide, and you can get the benefits that way. And that is where if that can happen, then that's going to change society, in a good way. That will help people overcome their individual traumas, but also their community traumas, I mean, and we're all traumatized.
Of course.
You can't live in this society without being traumatized. So here's the medicine, here's the answer.
Yeah.
And anyway.
Well, no, I completely agree with you, and I'm very what gives me hope is the younger generations, like my generation and the generation below mine. There is a genuine keen interest and passion for this type of research to be more mainstream. We're just seeing the changing of the old guard. I guess that's all this really is we're just seeing
Right.
the swapping out of an old paradigm for a new paradigm. It's coming in, and I personally think it's unavoidable. It's like what you said, it's a time issue, and we need to get it down quickly. Otherwise, we may miss the opportunity to fully benefit from this before we drag ourselves down through all the problems we've been causing already. So we do need this to come in, and I do have optimism it will. And the thing that really interests me, I suppose, with psychedelics is just the questions it brings up about reality. I mean, I was fortunate enough to get connected to you through a mutual friend, Dr. John Dean, and I interviewed him because
Oh, yeah.
I came across the paper he co-authored that examined the concentrations of DMT in mammalian brains through the research they discovered that DMT could be in concentrations, as you most likely know, within human biochemistry at levels similar to serotonin, which is a fundamental hormone, which would just be absolutely mind-blowing. And if this was confirmed, I imagine this would open up all sorts of doors, because if we couple the possibility with this possibility of DMT being that prevalent in the brain, if we couple that with the understandings that can be found in quantum mechanics, if all things are simply a fundamental energetic force or series of forces being represented in different forms through changes in, as Nikola Tesla would say, vibration and frequency. If reality as we see it is nothing more than a frequency specific state, then the fact that DMT, a compound that's endogenous to our biochemistry, has within it the capability to melt away the walls around you and project you into a hyperspatial domain that's inhabited apparently by intelligent entities. I mean, surely this speaks volumes to the malleability of our interface with reality, and would surely cause us to ask the questions about what reality even is, if it can be so easily folded away and replaced with something so novel.
No, John's work is
Yeah.
groundbreaking and paradigm changing. Very important work, and I hope that his work gets more recognition, because it is exactly as you say. I've often said that these things, that we construct what I call the reality hallucination, and we inhabit the reality hallucination, which some people call this the default mode network, or that's another way to look at it. But it's essentially an artificial, it's a model of reality that we inhabit, because the brain can only process so much information. And it's like, in constructing the reality hallucination, this model of reality, it's something the brain has evolved to do so that we can make sense out of what's happening. I mean, what it does, the brain has all sorts of mechanisms for excluding information, for very selectively allowing this plethora of information that comes through our sensory channels and on the inside. If there were no filters on that, it would just be a blooming, buzzing confusion, and the brain has evolved to take this data and construct a representation of reality that works for us, in our day-to-day lives, ordinary day-to-day consciousness. But like a computer hard drive, it can get clutched up, and that's when you get these dysfunctions like trauma and mental illness and that sort of thing. So these serotonergic psychedelics are like, they provide a reset. I really think it's very similar to rebooting your hard drive, when you have these high dose transformative experiences, it cleans a lot of stuff out, and the default mode network, or the reality hallucination, is very resilient. You can't destroy it. Well, you can. In rare instances, you can disable it and you can't recover, but that's very rare. In most cases, it will reorganize, it will reconstitute itself, but it runs more smoothly afterwards. And I think that, in a sense, that's the core of the therapeutic action of psychedelics. They let you shift your perspective away from this, step out of this reference frame temporarily, and look at it and your place, and understand a lot about your own personal dynamics. And in re sort of reconstructing that, that's where the therapeutic process takes place, is the ability to temporarily disable that and look at things from a different perspective. And that's the root, I think, of the perception that we're not separate from everything else, the cosmic oneness and all of that. Because that is really what it is, that's how we are, but we can't necessarily be in that state all the time, or we couldn't get anything done, and so we have to create this, this impoverished, essentially, model of reality that we inhabit, and even though it's impoverished, it's still incredibly rich. And we just don't always have the understanding of how much more there is beyond it. And psychedelics open up that doorway temporarily. That's what they do.
Yeah. Well, the person that opened me up to it the most was your brother. And I'd love to talk about Terence for a moment, because he's
Sure.
a truly unique individual. I mean, a truly unique mind, and has become a cultural phenomenon in of himself, with his lectures preserved and passed around by hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people around the world. Truly amazing. As his brother, how would you describe Terence?
Well, Interesting you should mention this because my book, my memoir, The Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss, which has now been out of print for a while, you can still get the Kindle edition. But I'm in process of rereading the whole thing because I'm gonna bring out a second edition of it. I've actually signed a contract with Synergetic
Oh, fantastic.
Press, so we're gonna do a second edition. I'm gonna write a new chapter for it, and and so that's in the process. That's one of the things in the hopper right now. So it's forced me to think about all of this, and the kind of pathways that we went down. And my brother, being 4 years older than me, was leading me down some primrose pathways. But then, we got to a place where we were exploring these things together. And Terence was definitely a game changer, just in terms of his ability to articulate these things, And so I have great respect for what he did. At the same time, I, had differences in a certain way, or as things evolved over the decades, we sort of diverged in the way that we understood, for example, the experiment at La Chorrera, and what did that really mean, and then some of the ideas that came out of it, like the time wave and this sort of thing. Very interesting ideas. But I think Terence, in some ways, did himself a disservice because he in his public life, he talked a lot about the time wave. And the time wave is interesting, but basically, I don't think it's valid, And so there are lots of reasons why it's not valid. And he was very married to this idea and talked about it. And then also the sort of the idea that we were, that the mushrooms maybe was some kind of an extraterrestrial intelligence, or that they were a, the mushrooms were a channel to this. And I don't really think so. I think that the mushrooms are a channel to an intelligence, but it's a terrestrial intelligence. You cannot make a case, really, if you look at it, that the mushrooms are extraterrestrial. And I don't know whether he ever really took that seriously, but they're thoroughly enmeshed in the evolutionary biology of the planet. They're not extraterrestrial. Lately I've come to think that the maybe the way to think about this communication with aliens and entities that are not human, in some ways, if you look at the planetary constellation of life, in some ways we're the aliens. We're the ones that are the most out of sync with the rest of life on Earth, and I think part of our task is to actually, rather than be focused on the connection with extraterrestrial aliens, we should try to refocus on how do we communicate and actually engage in a dialogue with this planetary size intelligence, which is comprised of the community of species on the planet. So anyway, Terence and I, we didn't really get into that when he was around. He was a very interesting fellow, as we all know, because of his ability to speak. I mean, he was really a bard in some ways, and he could articulate the most cockamamie, wildest, craziest ideas, and make it make sense, or
Make it
make
make
people
sense.
make and at least convince people that it did make sense. It used to be I mean, because he was so good at it,
He
you know,
was, yeah.
he could do this. So he could, and he loved that. He loved to, you know, really provoke these things. And he hated, he, well, he didn't hate, but he didn't like it when I attended his talks and so on. You know, because I was the only person that would stand up and say, well,
Damn it, Dennis.
Right. I mean, he even say, I would say, look, you know, so 20 minutes ago you said this, which didn't make any sense. Now you may say this, which doesn't make any sense. And it's the complete opposite. And he said, well, you know, consistency is the hobgoblin of small minds, you know. At which point I would sit down and shut up and he would just roll on, you know. So, you know, you gotta love him. I mean, you just gotta love him. He was such a wonderful raconteur, I think,
Yeah.
a storyteller and a raconteur and a Irishman. And, you know, I just, I mean, this book has really made it, you know, as I read over on our trip to La Chirera, you know, which happened a long, long time ago. And most of our lives were lived out after that. And so in some ways, always what we've lived has been a reflection of those events, or kind of that shadow of those events has been over the rest of our lives. But I just think about him, and you know, I miss him a lot, and I really have to wonder what would he think about what's happened, where we are now, because I think he'd have some very interesting things to
Well, that
say.
was actually going to be what I'd ask you next. What do you think he would say if he was here looking at the world that we're in today, especially because so many of his predictions did come to fruition through technology, virtual reality, the internet. I mean, he was ahead of his time. What do you think he would think then?
Absolutely ahead of his time. Well, I think for one thing, he'd say, well, what did I tell you? You know, I don't think that he would be surprised at all. You know, I think he really would say, because he'd been talking about this since the early, late 80s, early 90s, about the planetary crisis that we're facing and all that. So he would be, you know, I'm really sorry that we don't have the benefit of his wisdom and his sense of humor and his perspective, because he would have a lot to say about it. But I think, you know, so yes, on a certain level, I think Terence was right, you know, but on one level, like he was always talking about the time wave, and there will be at some point some cataclysmic, some instantaneous shift in the reality hallucination,
Yeah,
if you
the
will, or the
eschaton.
reality that, yeah, the eschaton, it's all going to come down, you know, in the final few
Pro
seconds.
he'd probably still be screaming that now by the looks of the world.
Well, but it's but what's emerging is that effectively it's not happening. Like we used to talk about novelty, this idea of novelty. And he was saying, well, novelty is something that bursts into the continuum, you know, these events that are so catalytic and cataclysmic, and like the, you know, the first time that that fission on the surface of the planet took place. That was a novel event. But all the stuff that led up to that were also novel events. But happened much quietly, much more quietly when no one is noticing. So when we used to talk about this, I said to him many times, I don't think I agree about novelty. I agree that there are new things under the sun every day, things that have never happened before in the history of the universe. But novelty does not burst into the continuum. Novelty sort of leaks into the continuum. You know, it's a slower process. Like all the innovations and understandings that had to take place leading up to the ability to detonate a nuclear bomb on the surface of the Earth. You had to have Einstein's insights, you know, so you see what I mean?
He's the
Novelty.
burst hypothesis, you're the
Yeah,
leak
he's
hypothesis.
yeah. Yeah, it's the pump tape versus the steady state perspective. And I think novelty does build up, in the continuum, and maybe it appears that it accelerates. And so in a sense, he was right. I mean, forget the time wave in a certain sense, the mathematics and the projections of the time wave tied to one particular date, 2012, obviously that was wrong. But the
Maybe
synth,
it's this December.
well, it, yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, you're talking about billion year time scale, so it wouldn't be surprised if you're off by a few years. But I think the take-home lesson from Terence's insights about novelty is that I mean, in that sense, he was correct. If you look at what's happened within, just for example, since Terence died. I mean, Terence died in 2000, and the world was odd enough then, but really compared to now,
Things have
so
stepped
things
up
have
a
just
little
gotten weirder and weirder and weirder and weirder. Yeah. And so at a certain point you look up and you say, yes, everything's different and everything is different, and this is what we're living through. And so, we have to adapt to it some way. But I don't dismiss his insights about novelty. I think he was right on the money. I just think that in the classic sort of way that prophets do, beware of making prophecies that are tied to particular dates,
Dates.
because you're gonna be wrong. I mean, you can count on it, you're not, and that's been the way it is, and that's the way all prophecies are. But in some sense, there's a kernel of truth in it, and that's why I like science fiction so much, because I think science fiction is the literature of the age, and it's a way to really understand what's happening. And Terry and I have been science fiction fans since the early 60s. I mean, our dad turned us onto science fiction, not psychedelics, but science fiction. I mean, he was afraid, he was not open to psychedelics, but science fiction. But that gave us a framework, along with all the other stuff, the Jungian psychology, alchemy, all of these things that we were kind of steeped in for understanding. And if you look around these days, if you just look, you say, what the fuck? We're living in a science fiction world. I mean, it's all true. It is a science fiction world. Everything that is on the news and everything else, social media, the COVID virus, the AI, all of this stuff was visualized by science fiction writers decades ago. And in that,
I sometimes wish it was taking a more utopian bent, but
well, one thing I want to mention to you that I'm talking to everybody about, and I'm giving this book out to all my friends and everyone I care about, is this book came out in 2020 by Kim Stanley Robinson. It's called The Ministry for the Future. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Well, you should order it, and you should tell people about it. It's science fiction, yes, but it's actually a I think it's a future history of the next 30 years. That's what it is, and it's a way to imagine how things are going to unfold if we wake up and if we begin to respond to the challenges that we face. So in that sense, it's one of the most hopeful things I've read for in a long time about climate change and all of this. And it starts out pretty grim, but the thing that's interesting about the book is it's packed with information that I mean, about policy. It's like almost a policy manifesto,
Right, okay.
and it's a very, very stimulating and thought-provoking book, and I highly recommend it. Actually, Obama called it the most important book he read in
Oh,
2020.
wow. Okay. Well,
So
I'll definitely
that.
take the recommendations of yourself and Obama on that one.
Yeah, actually, yeah, it's been really, I mean, it was a good, and I got, it was Tim Ferriss that originally brought it to my attention, but I've given copies to many people this Christmas, so there it
Okay,
is.
I'll definitely keep that in mind. Have you how are you doing for time? Are you all right for a few more questions or?
Sure, I don't have anything coming up for a couple hours, so I'm good.
I appreciate that. Well, speaking of sci-fi, I'd be very interested in getting your thoughts on the UFO issue. I'm guessing you must be aware of at least some degree of what's been taking place with the US government.
Yes, yeah, I am. I haven't been following it, like too closely, but I think that it's again, it's a hopeful sign where the government is saying, well, yes, something's going on. Something is going on. And so that's a hopeful sign that they're actually acknowledging that what's been obvious for, excuse me, for decades. But beyond that, I do not think anybody knows what's really going on. I don't think the government knows. I don't think anybody knows.
No.
I mean, what do you think's going on?
Well, I mean, this is a the UFO issue is a key interest of mine because I've had some experiences which very much changed my perspective on both UFOs and consciousness, but it appears to me at least to interpenetrate a space between consciousness or spirit and quantum mechanics or material science. These two perspectives or points of observation appear to be coupled together and represented by the UFO, which at least to me represents an exquisite technological capability that appears to operate symbiotically with the energy or the framework of consciousness. I mean, I personally view, and this is coming from a research background into this, because I've done a lot of research into the UFO field, and I've also had these very intense personal experiences. But I personally view the UFO as like a techno-spiritual vehicle of some form that can not just traverse the skies and the vacuum of the cosmos, but it can traverse the dimensions of space and time, which may include what we would call the astral realms or the psychedelic realms. And because I truly believe that a symbiosis between spirit and science must take place, I actually do find myself sharing in the opinion of your brother when Terence said that these flying saucers are haunting our skies as a symbol of where we're fated to go, that they might be some sort of shadow being projected by the future outcome of our species. I at least find that to be a very provocative idea.
Yeah, I do too. I'm basically we're on the same page more or less about
Yeah.
that. I think that you're probably familiar with Jung's essay,
Yeah.
UFOs, a modern myth of things seen in the sky. I think he
Yes.
had it right. I think these are not, these are not, alien ships piloted by, aliens. I don't, well. The thing is, nobody actually knows what they are, but I don't think that's what they are. I think it is. I think your intuition is correct. There's something that exists in the quantum realm on the edge of, ordinary reality and non-ordinary reality. They may be material, they may be partly, partly material, partly spiritual or mental or whatever. I do not think we really know what they are, but it's interesting that if you read the Brotherhood of the Screaming Abyss or Terence's novel, Terence's book True Hallucinations and the Experiment at La Chimera, effectively what we were trying to do was build one of these artifacts. You know, we were trying to build an artifact that was made of matter and mind, you know, and so that is, you know, I think historically the reflection of that idea. Now the modern reflection is the UFO idea.
Yeah.
But before, you know, the philosopher's stone, the time machine, the you know, the idea of this
kind of alchemical object.
Yeah, it exactly. It is a real thing. It is a biological thing, possibly. And it is the ultimate artifact, you know, in a certain way. This is what we were trying to do at La Chirera, was essentially build our own bodies, our own DNA into a UFO, you know, or what would be. I mean, we postulated that if our experiment succeeded, which it didn't, not in the way that we thought it would anyway, but if it had succeeded, you know, the result of that would have been an object made of DNA and a fusion of mind and matter, so that you would actually have this thing that you could, they could both see it and be it at the same time. You know, and you, it would be like a scrying mirror or a magic mirror that the alchemists talked about. And you see this talked about in shamanism too, the idea that you can create this substance out of the body that is like a portal into other dimensions. You can see things far away. You can see things in the future. So the human species is haunted by this idea of a biotechnological instantiation of something, of that this is the ultimate artifact. Because if you had one of those babies, everything else is irrelevant. It is the ultimate artifact, you know. And
yeah.
So, like Terence talked about, it's the transcendental object at the end of time, you know. And to invent this object or to create this object, you know, which we claimed you could do if you sang to the mushroom in a certain state and, you know, did these various things, you could create this thing. Once you've created it, it totally changes the whole game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I read, you may have heard of Whitley Strieber.
You've
heard
yeah.
Of course, you've heard of Whitley Strieber. And he, and, you know, he's a guy that I used to dismiss, you know, and ridicule a lot, but I didn't ridicule him publicly, but I didn't take him seriously, you know. I thought he's off, but then this book came out with that Whitley Strieber and Jeffrey Kripal wrote, and I forget the title. It was
I can't remember either now. Not Communion. Communion?
No, this was much later. This
okay.
was a collaboration. I remember the subtitle was a New Understanding of the Unexplained.
Right.
Subtitle. I don't remember. But I read that. And have you read that book?
No, I haven't. I've read Communion.
It's a, it's very interesting because I know Jeffrey Kripal. You know, I know him pretty well. And he's not a screwball. He's a professor of mythology, really, and comparative religions. And so the book is kind of a dialogue between those two. One chapter is, you know, Whitley telling these crazy stories, you know, and then Jeffrey coming in and unpacking this and saying, well, what does this mean, you know? And not really dismissing it, kind of like saying, well, okay, let's take him at his word. Let's assume that these things did happen to him. So then what does that mean? It's a fantastic book. And later on in the book, they talk about, well, what does this actually mean on the physical level? What's the physics behind these things? And so later in the book, there was a chapter that was titled, I think it was called The Soul as UFO. And I saw that and I said, holy fuck, this is it, you know? And they were talking about it in those respects. And I said, not only is the soul a UFO, that is, in some ways, that's one instantiation of the soul. But at La Chorrera, you know, we were getting downloaded the blueprints of how to build one of these things, you know, and that was the whole thing. I mean, people look at the experiment at La Chorrera. We approached it like, you know, for us, it wasn't a spiritual experience exactly. It wasn't like we're headed seeking enlightenment. We looked at it like aerospace engineers. We were trying to build an artifact. You know, and we looked at it from that perspective. So, you know, and we missed the mark, obviously, but maybe we triggered some events or some ripple in the space-time continuum that says now we're seeing some of those like gravitational waves. You know, they move out into the continuum and they come back on you, and maybe that's contributing
Well,
to the high weirdness, you
I would
know.
be I'd be tempted to agree with the ripples through time and space. I mean, one of the primary reasons why I personally feel that consciousness and science coalesce within the UFO subject is due to my own personal experiences, because my experiences with this phenomenon were precipitated by me engaging in deeper levels of consciousness through meditation. So what I mean by that is that I was getting into a meditative state and began to clearly project an intention that I wanted to see something, that I wanted to have evidence of another intelligence out there. And I was in my back garden, you know, at night, looking up at the stars, and I ended up having a series of extremely profound experiences with what I can only describe as orange orbs of light. And I can go into detail with this if you would like, but this is why I'm fascinated by the psychedelic space and how it shares similarities with the UFO phenomenon through the bridge of consciousness. And for the record, I was sober when I had these experiences, but I was engaging in deeper levels of consciousness, and the result was a series of experiences with quote unquote UFO phenomenon, something flying around in the skies, which I couldn't identify, which pretty much felt like a psychedelic experience because it had a drastic effect on my perspective, on my view of reality, and it changed my trajectory in life to the point where I created this platform where I could have discussions with other people about these issues. So it was a profoundly catalyzing moment in my life.
So many people, I mean, this was something that came out in Whitley's book. You know, I haven't read all of his book. After I read this one, which, gosh, I wish I could think of the title, but anyway, after I read that, then I went back and read some of his stuff, and I believe that he did have these experiences. And something that he also remarked after he wrote his first book, he started getting all kinds of letters from people that had similar experiences. This is extremely common,
Oh yeah,
apparently,
I
that
get
people
lots of
have
emails,
this.
lots and lots of emails.
So what this tells us is that there's a realm of phenomena that's out there. You can't ignore it. People have these experiences, and they're not. I mean, maybe they're deluded, maybe these are hallucinations, but the commonality of it, and the, I mean, I'm sure hallucinations are a component of it, you know, but I think this is another reminder from nature, you know, which I think nature, psychedelics also, one of the big lessons I take away from psychedelics or ayahuasca is remember how little you know. You know, you think you know so much. Actually, you don't know shit. You know, and science, you know, can be very arrogant about stuff. And there are certain faction of scientists who like to say, well, you know, we pretty much have this figured out. They are so deluded. You know, we have a very, very tiny fraction of reality actually nailed down. And the beauty of science is it's always subject to, if it's properly practiced, it's always subject to revision and questioning and that's the way it works. You know, you develop hypotheses and then you develop a way to test the hypothesis, and it either stands up or you have to modify it or you have to throw it out the window. You know, and that's one of the powers that science has that other modes of inquiry have lack. You know, and so if you practice science honestly, you have to be open to the fact that everything you think you know is probably wrong, you know, or maybe wrong. And so you can't just dismiss these people's experiences because they have these experiences. And knowing what we know, knowing about how, you know, the brain really does construct this artificial reality, or this, well, it's not artificial, but this, what would be the term? This engineered reality that we create for ourselves, that implies that beyond that membrane, there's another
Something
aspect of
else.
reality that would be very hard to comprehend if we could perceive it. We can only perceive it in special states like psychedelic states or spontaneous mystical experiences or UFO experiences. I mean, there's a reason, you know, why Rick Strassman's work with DMT, you know, at the high doses resembled abduction and alien encounter type experiences, you know, because it's all part of a continuum. You know, will we ever get this figured out? Who knows? You know.
Well, do you think the psychedelic space can ever be truly understood by us, or will it always just be off the edge of what's possible to quantify? Because it just is such an abstract realm.
I think that you know, I mean, and the thing with psychedelics, the thing with, well, maybe the thing with psychedelics, but any, so science can look at aspects of the psychedelic experience and quantify it in all sorts of ways, you know, but they can't get at the root of what is actually happening. You know, there's this disconnect between what we can experience subjectively, you know, which we can explain really, and then what we can study objectively using the instruments of science, whether those be neural imaging technologies or even just psychological profiling questionnaires and that sort of thing. I mean, yeah, 70% of the subjects said this was the most meaningful experience of their lives. Well, that's nice. What was the
Yeah, exactly.
experience?
What does that mean?
What does that really mean? And that's the big challenge for neuroscience, I think, right now, is we know that we have a subjective state. You know, we know that we have consciousness, and yet we, in order to study that, we have to stand outside of it, you know, and we can't get to the root of it. And so that's the big challenge for neuroscience, I think, is will we ever figure it out? When are we going to have a machine, you know, or a technology where I can have a psychedelic experience and I can project it outside so that you can watch it, you know, or maybe into your head? I don't know. I mean, the telepathy and all that's a real, that does take place. So I think the answer is we just don't have the tools right now to fully explore this. But that's the holy grail of neuroscience. How do you link subjective experience, subjective consciousness to neural processes? You know, and I think it's also you know, a mistake to assume that neural processes is all there is to it. You know, I mean, neural processes certainly seem to be involved, but there's, you know, reason to think that some of this information doesn't originate in the brain, you know, and you know, because the brain is a receiver of information, right? And so then where is this coming from? You know, and you talk about this stuff and you have to talk about things like within the framework of it, you have to talk about things. Well, this came from outside, this came from over there rather than in here. But these terms are meaningless if you're talking about that, So
Yeah, I think I think we're just maybe rounding the corner where those tools might start to become available to us through things like quantum computation and advancements in technology, where we might be able to create projections of what exactly is going on in these psychedelic spaces. So I have optimism for where we might go when it comes to that. And I guess it's such a shame that we've had to. I mean, it's good that it's happening now, but it's such a shame that it's been delayed for just so long, because we could be at that point now or much further ahead than what we're seeing at the moment, which is we're literally starting at almost square one, and having to try and develop it as fast as we can. And I wonder, like, if psychedelics had never been demonized and the research of the 50s and 60s had continued on up to present day, just as a hypothetical, I mean, where do you think we'd be as a species now compared to where we've arrived without the benefit of research and usage of plant medicines?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think we'd be further along for sure on the path to really understanding what consciousness is. But, I mean, long before there was science, there were wise people and sages and shamans and people like this who thought about these things, and have to look at like Eastern religions and things like that. They had pretty good models for the way it's probably structured, So I don't see that. I mean, the thing is, science is only one of the arrows in the quiver, if you will. There are other tools we have to apply. And and this is why I mean, this is why I call the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy, because natural philosophy, science grew out of natural philosophy. Natural philosophy had a wider perspective. Science lost a lot when it became reductionist and quantitative, and started to insist that, the only path to knowledge of the world was you had to be able to measure stuff, and it was quantitative. This is the whole Cartesian dualism, the separation of subjective inner experience from the outer world.
who apparently received that information from an angel.
Right, so there you go. I mean, that just shows you. Well, the angel was propagating misinformation.
You can't trust them, not every time.
You can't trust the angels, because they have their own agenda. It's bullshit. You can't separate it, So I think that we would be incrementally further along. But really, science has not looked at psychedelics, seriously for more than a few decades. Before that, and psychedelics have been around for a long time, and the knowledge of it was in the shamanic traditions and the mystical traditions, and so there is that body of knowledge, and the idea of natural philosophy is there are other ways of knowing, that are valid. It doesn't have to be quantitative. It doesn't have to be reductionist at all. So science made a lot of sacrifices in order to, become what we think of as science, and the danger is that, in some ways it almost had to do that. The danger is that if you open the pathways and say, well, there's all sorts of ways to know that are not scientific. Yes, there are, but there's also a lot of misinformation out there, and it encourages a certain amount of fuzzy thinking in a way. If you don't have that analytical, skeptical capability, but science errs too far in that direction. So this is part of, I think, the process that we're engaged in as trying to understand what is the place of science, what is the place of consciousness in our apprehension of the world, you know, because at the end of the day, we have only one thing, you know, and that's experience. Experience is all there is, you know, and the past and the future and everything else that we think there is, all of these are part of this hallucination that we construct. But you know, and so if you start with that as a datum, you know, there's only the present moment, there's only our experience, then you know, that's a place to start. And but it also forces you to think differently about what's real and what is not. These terms are very tricky, you know, what's real and what is not. I sort of start from the notion that anything you experience is real, you know, because it can be experienced. That means it's real. You're experiencing it right now, whether it's physical or not, whether it's inside, whether it's outside, then you can start that argument. But you have to accept anything you can experience. Whatever can be experienced has a certain fundamental reality to it, you know, because we can experience it.
Before we wrap up here, and that was fantastic, by the way. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation, Dennis. Are you optimistic for humanity in the long run? I know that's a heavy question, but we've got so much going on right now in this world. Are you optimistic about the long term?
Well, I sometimes tell people Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays I'm an optimist. I'm a pessimist the rest of the time. Basically, yes, I am. I am optimistic. Not only for humanity, but I think I'm optimistic for life on Earth. I think that life on Earth is extremely resilient, you know, and we've seen this through hundreds, literally billions of years of evolution. And there have been points in the existence of life on Earth where 90% of every terrestrial life of terrestrial species, marine species, were wiped out, you know, due to different events, you know, cataclysmic climate change, asteroid impacts, and this sort of thing. And it's always recovered. And what is what ha what we've seen is that you get this complete, often ablation of species. The number goes down, but then in the following epochs, which play out over hundreds of millions of years, right? This is part of the problem. We can't think of those terms, but they play out over hundreds of millions of years. You get this explosion of diversity and complexity, you know, in the next epoch. It's like you clear the playing field, and now whatever's left after you've done that has the opportunity to move into these niches and really explode in complexity. So that's encouraging, you know, but we don't think on those terms. I mean, you know, you've looked at different, I'm sure, time scales, ways of looking at it. Where the entire career of the human species, depending on how far you want to go back, but if you compress these things down, it's happening in the last few seconds of what's happened so far. You know, so I think that we just don't know. We just don't know. And there's always the possibility that something's going to come along that really changes the game in some way, you know, and I am open to that. I hope that that will happen. And but I don't worry so much. I think life on Earth will survive, you know, and reestablish the equilibrium, which won't be the same as in the past, but and we as a species may not survive. We are at risk for sure. but maybe not. Maybe we will survive. I think that, again, I think intelligence is built into the equation. So
Yes, yeah.
maybe we're an experiment that fails, but maybe the next one will succeed. So, I sometimes say Gaia is one tough bitch. Gaia is going to survive. We may
Yeah,
not,
no
but
doubt
if
about that.
but if we're smart, we can get through this. Well, that's the thing. We have to wake up and we have to wise up. And that's the cusp of where we are at right now. And we see the window closing,
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I
It's
do know I probably won't be around to see the resolution of this, and maybe nobody will. I don't
maybe
know, nobody
nobody
alive
will.
today.
Yeah, but you're certainly assisting and putting the groundwork in for that kind of thing to be developed upon with the work that you're doing, Dennis. So it's not like you're just sitting back and watching the world burn. You're actually trying to do something about that, and that's extremely admirable.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I do my best in some small way, and I
It's all you can do.
try to focus on what I can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. I mean, you're such an intelligent
Likewise.
and thank you. You're an intelligent and kind soul, and I think you're doing amazing work in this world at a time when we really do need it the most. And I would highly recommend everyone listening to check out the McKenna Academy. I'll put a link in the description box below for anyone who wants to listen to sorry, not listen, but check out the website and see what it is you're doing. But aside from that, Dennis, I'd just like to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. It's been really, really insightful.
Well, thank you, Jay. Yes, it's been a real pleasure. It's been great to talk to you. Let me know when this is posted. We've got social media people that are eager to post the links everywhere. We're getting good at this. So of course, we want to get this message out, and and maybe we'll see you in the UK later in the year. If you can come to this event, that'd
I
be
would be
great.
very, very interested in coming to that event. So I'll keep in contact with you in the background, and you can let me know when it's leading up to that. And it would be an honor to be there.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Well, have a wonderful holiday season and all the best in 20, where are we now?
2022 now, I know.
2022.
It's been pretty much like you can just cancel the last 2 years off. I mean,
Boy,
it's
that's for sure.
Right. So yeah, don't
Things do
worry
seem
about
to be accelerating, but
that.
anyway. So, all right. Very good, Jay. Thanks so much. I'm sorry it took so long to finally get this done, but
Oh no, not a problem at all.
unmitigated pleasure. So thank you.
You're welcome.